Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, with my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski, and he is actually the second best endocrinologist on this. We always say that when another endocrinologist comes on. Otherwise, he's the best. we have Dr. Richard Aukus coming here. He's an adrenal guru, steroid, all the stuff with cortisol, all the different steroids regarding the adrenal glands. And my brother invited him on to kind of talk about things like Cushing's, and maybe we can get into some of the myths of adrenal fatigue and some of these new drugs that are coming out that that treat the cortisol metabolism. So welcome. Thanks. And he's at the U of M. We won't hold that again.
Yeah. As we're Spartans, it does kind of hurt me sometimes when we're hanging out, but I do want to say, you know, on social media, podcasts and stuff, terms like renowned and stuff get thrown around way too much. He really is renowned. And I know it might sound kind of nerdy coming from an endocrinologist, but he's one of those guys where when we were fellows, my group in fellowship, it's like, hey, he's a superstar. Like we really looked up to a lot of these guys that would teach us from, you know, nationally, globally. And so very, very legitimately renowned and an awesome speaker. And so really, thanks for coming on and hope you have some fun.
Well, thank you, Carl. And, you know, Einstein said that he stood on the shoulders of giants. And what I know is only because I also had mentors as well.
Good. All right. Well, I'm going to let my brother, he had a bunch of questions he was going to go through. We can give a little bit of a background. You're an MD, PhD.
Yeah, a little bit of a background in how you got into the adrenal, that being the focus, and what the heck are the adrenal glands anyways?
So, you know, I was a chemistry major at MIT, and I loved organic chemistry, and I loved bioorganic chemistry, and I did enzyme reaction mechanisms during the latter parts of my undergraduate work. And then when I went to the MD-PhD program at Washington University, I wanted to find a lab that did something similar, and the lab I worked in was Doug Covey's lab, and Doug was the guy who synthesized the first aromatase inhibitors back in the 70s. And what we did is we studied estrogen metabolizing enzymes. And so I had to learn about steroid hormones and, you know, their pathways and stuff. And when it came time to pick a clinical field, I said, well, who does steroids? And they said, that's endocrinology. And I said, okay, I'll be an endocrinologist. And it actually worked out pretty well. And so, you know, I do pituitary adrenal reproductive disorders and the overlap. But I think right now, the biggest explosion in information is in the adrenal between primary aldosteronism, the new treatments for congenital adrenal hyperplasia and Cushing's syndrome, both the new treatments and the recognition that even mild forms can be pathologic. And, you know, that's, I think, what we'll be getting into today.
Yeah. We're going to talk a little bit about that for sure. So, and now we did, Spencer, I think maybe you and I were the ones that just did a little cortisol 101 and just kind of went over the basics. But, you know, just for you, because you'll say it differently and probably better for, especially for the lay public listening to this, you know, what are the adrenal glands, the basics of it? What is cortisol and its functions beyond, you know, what people say? It's our stress hormone. I think we probably all kind of say that, but it's right. So much more beyond that.
Yeah. So there are four different zones of the adrenal gland, three in the cortex and one in the medulla. And the medulla makes catecholamines, epinephrine, which is a stress hormone. And in parallel, the middle of the three zones of the cortex makes cortisol. And so most of the time, you don't need cortisol. So that's one important thing. But when you're sick or when you're hemorrhaging or when you're exercising or when you're trying to get up in the morning, you do need cortisol, or at least it helps a lot. And so the body has a circadian rhythm where cortisol is sleep in chain. This is why we have jet lag when we fly overseas, is because the body knows it's supposed to go to sleep at a certain time and then get up at a certain time. And when the cortisol rises in the early morning hours, that increases your glucose. It activates certain regions of the brain, and it helps you to get up in the morning. And then it actually declines pretty quickly. And throughout the rest of the day, it's pretty low. And when you try to go to sleep at night, it really should be zero. But what can happen to people is either because of tumors that make cortisol themselves, or that drive the adrenals to make cortisol, you can lose that circadian rhythm or have a blunted circadian rhythm. And that leads to pathologic problems because, as I'm sure you guys have done many times on this podcast, the body goes through anabolic and catabolic cycles. And cortisol is a catabolic hormone. It breaks down skin, muscle, bone to make glucose to feed the brain, so that when you go to sleep overnight and you're not eating, that you don't die of hypoglycemia. Cortisol is one of those hormones that makes sure that body tissues are broken down to fuel the brain's metabolism. And then you're supposed to not make cortisol, and you're supposed to have an anabolic cycle that's mediated by testosterone, growth hormone, and other insulin, other anabolic hormones. And that's how the body repairs itself from those times when cortisol is present, catabolizing the tissues. Now, what happens if cortisol never goes down? Well, then you have a chronic catabolic state. And that is what leads to the Cushing syndrome. And the features of Cushing syndrome that are specific are those things that reflect the catabolic actions of cortisol. So skin thinning with these violaceous striae, which are hemorrhage into expanding skin, the fat redistribution, the muscle weakness, which is super, super specific for cortisol excess, and osteoporosis without any other cause. So I think that's kind of one component to it. And then, of course, if you never make cortisol and you get sick, that's adrenal insufficiency. And because your body can't mount this response to an acute illness, that can be fatal because the cortisol is not only necessary to maintain your blood sugar, but it's also necessary to maintain your blood pressure when you're septic. Or when you're hemorrhaging and your blood pressure is low, the catecholamines that come from the adrenal medulla want to make the blood vessels constrict to perfuse your brain and your vital organs. They can't do that if you don't have cortisol. Cortisol has a permissive action on that. So too little is not good. Too much is definitely not good. And an absence of this circadian rhythm is not good. Yeah. So I think that's probably a good introduction. So you can, lead the discussion from here.
All right. So, yeah, I guess, you talked about the rhythm, the diurnal rhythm, and how that really helps us. And we can talk about how we diagnose these things. And mm-hmm. I think it's important for people to understand how the heck we diagnose, Cushing's syndrome or Cushing's disease, because we have all these places out there selling Dutch hormone testing and these.
Have you seen these?
Well, I've seen various things, and they're all kind of somewhat irrational. But
exactly. But then what they do is they tell everyone they have adrenal fatigue without diagnosing their actual fatigue, and then they sell them supplements, some of which, mind you, have, I think, like animal adrenal products in them, like bovine and porcine adrenal products, which is going to cause problems. But it blows our mind sometimes that these places are selling these what do they call them, Spencer? Like these daytime cortisol curves.
Like, and then diurnal, cortisol. Yeah,
they're checking salivary cortisol all throughout the day and saying it doesn't fit the curve. Oh, you have adrenal fatigue. And it's, and you know, and we obviously have very well validated, salivary cortisol for diagnosing Cushing's when it should be low at night. And I know you might even be involved in some of the studies to see if we can validate it for adrenal insufficiency. But maybe some basics on, I don't think people realize that you can't just start checking labs all the time. That's the other thing. Like Mark Hyman and the functional docs, they sell all these lab tests and they're just randomly getting cortisol and growth hormone and all these things. And I just find it hard for me to even articulate to people how we validate tests based on specificity and sensitivity for actual disease and all that stuff, and how these are just, people are just selling them stuff inappropriately.
Well, I think one very important thing to discuss is the fact that, you know, cortisol has a wide normal range. And, you know, if you measure cortisol in 100 different people at various times of the day, it's all over the place. And very few of these people have intrinsic adrenal disease. But because it is a stress hormone and because it is related to the sleep profile, many things that have nothing to do with the adrenal will have a secondary consequence on affecting your cortisol production. And the vast majority of people who have what I would say is an abnormal cortisol result, be it a day curve or whatever, actually don't have any adrenal disease. They have either physical or mental illness, chronic disease, medications, and probably number one is sleep disorders. And those then mess with your circadian rhythm. And so, for example, someone who has sleep apnea, you know, they don't get a good night's sleep. They wake up periodically. When they wake up, their sympathetic nervous system goes nuts. They activate their adrenal axis. So they actually have too much cortisol at night. And that cortisol at night then suppresses the normal function of the circadian rise in cortisol. And then when you measure it in the morning, it's actually low. So they have what we call a flattened circadian rhythm. Now, if you give them a provocative test to make cortisol, they'll make plenty of cortisol. And if you give them a high dose of dexamethasone to suppress their cortisol, they'll suppress. So they don't really have in endocrine disorder, but their endocrine system is affected by non-endocrine disease. You know, we do this all the time with thyroid disease. When people are ill, we have what we call non-thyroidal illness. It messes with your thyroid test. Actually, cortisol is partially involved in that. And this is the same thing is true with cortisol. So any test that you do, you have a pre-test probability of having the disease present. And the positive predictive value of that test is dependent on your pretest probability. So let's take adrenal insufficiency. We have a cosyntropin stimulation test that we do we give synthetic ACTH, which is the pituitary hormone that drives the adrenals to make cortisol. We give a bolus of that, and then we measure cortisol 30 to 60 minutes later. Now, that test has 99% sensitivity and specificity. So that sounds like a really good test. It sounds like you can't lose with that test, all right? But the prevalence of adrenal insufficiency in the general population is 1 in 10,000, okay? So if I randomly go doing a cosyntropin stimulation test on 10,000 people, I'm going to get 100 abnormal tests. And only one of those people actually has adrenal insufficiency. Mm-hmm. All right. So the positive predictive value is 1%, which is essentially useless because I didn't select the patients for having a high pretest probability. So what are the specific findings of adrenal insufficiency? Weight loss, number one, anorexia that goes along with that. You know, if people don't have those things, I don't even test them, right? You know, because it's not going to be forthcoming. Hyponatremia, hyperkalemia, and hypoglycemia. The people who are seeing these doctors to get these day curves, they don't have any of those things. Right. They're usually overweight they're not sleeping well. And you know, and so then their endocrine system is secondarily affected.
Now, though, so you're you know, talking about primary adrenal insufficiency.
Correct.
Right? So just at least just a little mention. Now, when I say primary adrenal insufficiency, for those listening, it's literally the adrenal glands themselves with disease.
Correct.
And there are a variety of causes of that. But, you know, I should ask you before I say this, I'm pretty sure, the most common cause of a secondary, meaning hypothalamic pituitary deficiency, has got to be just like the most common cause of Cushing's, which is medication. Is that
right?
Or not? Yeah, I mean,
correct. So, you know, if glucocorticoids, which is the general term for cortisol-like drugs, which would include prednisone, dexamethasone, triamcinolone, things like that, I think it's somewhere around 5 to 10% of the population is treated with these drugs.
That's
for
amazing.
Anti-inflammatory reasons. So, you know, for psoriasis, for eczema, for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, asthma, arthritis, Nobel Prize in 1950 for the discovery of cortisone, Hensch, Kendall, and Reichstein.
Yeah.
So when you take one of these things exogenously, then your body says, I don't need to make cortisol. And so it suppresses the action. Now that's a reversible cause. Reversible axis suppression or attenuation is definitely way more common than primary adrenal insufficiency. It's like, you know, a couple percent of the population. True central adrenal insufficiency that's not reversible due to a pituitary tumor or radiation or an infection that's involving the hypothalamus and pituitary, it's about the same prevalence as primary adrenal insufficiency.
Okay.
I thought it was more. Well, it probably is, but not more than an order of magnitude. Okay. It's not 1 in 100. It's not 1 in 10. It's maybe 1 in a few thousand, let's say, but maybe not 1 in 10,000. But axis suppression is way, way, way more common, you know, 1 in 10 or so.
Yeah.
So, So it's sort of just giving you those different gradations. And we can tell these apart by measuring ACTH as well as cortisol. So I think that's the other aspect. So, you know, if someone has a pituitary tumor, you know, they come to our pituitary clinic because somebody found a pituitary tumor on the MRI, well, then already I have a reason for them to maybe have adrenal insufficiency. So that makes me want to test them to make sure that that axis is functioning correctly.
Most of the people listening to this are probably going to want to know about excess, like Cushing's, I think.
Right.
Because they're always worried about, in fact, we should talk a little bit about it, but you can talk about the pathological causes, but then there's some people worried about excess exercise and resistance training in the morning.
Or the time of day to exercise, which is amazing to us. Yeah.
So maybe first touch on the pathological.
Let me address that first. So, you know, exercise is one of the most reproducible ways to increase your cortisol. Pat Duster at USHU's, which I forget, Carl, if you went there. But
I didn't go there, but we worked with him a lot when I was at Walter Reed.
When you were at Reed, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, Pat Duster did a number of studies. This putting somebody on the treadmill is one of the best ways to non-invasively increase their cortisol. So whether you're trying to exercise at a time of day when your cortisol is not high, if you're working hard, your cortisol is going to go up. And that's because, you know, it's actually part of that feed forward activation of the stress response to provide that glucose for your muscles to break down your, I wouldn't base it on that. I think the time of day that I exercise first thing in the morning, that's when I do it. You know, I go to swimming practice with the master's team, or I run, or I go to the gym and do some lifting. And that's because that's the only time of day I can fit it in. And I think, cause if I don't, I'm going to be lost and I'll never get it done. Some people like to work out at night. That's fine. I don't think I would worry so much about your hormones, but I would say two things. Don't mess with your sleep. And I'll say this a million times. Don't mess with your sleep. And make sure you have some protein within an hour after your workout to restore the muscle repair. But I think those are the only two things I would say. So, you know, you can't mess with cortisol. The other thing I'll say about cortisol is that cortisol always wins. I teach the fellows this all the time. So remember, we have these anabolic hormones, these catabolic hormones. So guess what happens when you're in the ICU? Your cortisol goes up, yeah. Right? And it stays up for a while. And so people have tried, you know, in these people, they're very catabolic because of course, people have tried to give them testosterone, growth hormone to stimulate the anabolic effect. Doesn't work because cortisol always wins, all right? And so, you know, again, it's key. What's key about cortisol is that you have a cortisol-free period every day, okay? So that if you get a good night's sleep and that your cortisol is down so that the anabolic hormones can repair you from all the damage during the day, okay? Now, let's talk about excess, all right? So the first thing that you can detect, you know, you don't wake up one day with Cushing's syndrome, which is cortisol excess. And I will say there is a little bit of confusion on the terminology. So I think, you know, when we talk about parathyroid excess, we talk about primary hyperparathyroidism or secondary hyperparathyroidism. We don't have an eponym for that. You could call it POTS syndrome, I suppose, but, you know, we call it primary or secondary. We can call it what it is, all right? With cortisol, we generally called it Cushing's syndrome, all right? Now, Harvey Cushing described a patient with very, very advanced cortisol excess back in the 1930s. And she had all those catabolic features, muscle weakness, osteoporosis, weak skin, stretch marks, all the rest. Now, so that's how we called it, Cushing syndrome. So if you wait until somebody's almost dead like that, you've really not done them a service. So we really now try to pick up people earlier and earlier with this disease so that we can cure them and restore them to health. Because if you, the longer you wait, the harder it is for them to recover and the less complete their recovery. And then we found out that when we pick people up earlier and earlier, they don't look like this patient who had the Cushing syndrome. And so as we go to milder and milder forms, the traditional findings are not common. And so then it becomes a very strong index of suspicion to pick this up. So when somebody has overt Cushing syndrome, it's pretty easy. All right. You can measure cortisol dynamics in one of three ways. You can measure a 24-hour urine cortisol. That gives you an integrated measure of what cortisol is making, how much cortisol you're making all through the day. You can measure a saliva cortisol at bedtime through a referral lab, not somebody's basement, but, you know, Mayo Clinic or Quest or ARUP. You know, your local lab will know to mail it to one of these people because they don't do it in-house. So, and then, you know, when you go to sleep, it should be zero or pretty close to zero. If it's not, that's not normal. And then the third way is to try to suppress it by giving a synthetic steroid. We usually give dexamethasone at bedtime and we measure morning cortisol. And if your thermostat is working right, your pituitary will perceive the dexamethasone and say, oh, we don't need to make cortisol, and you won't make any cortisol in the morning. It will be less than one. And so those are the three ways we sort this out. When somebody has overt Cushing's, all those tests are abnormal, every one of them, okay? Doesn't really matter what you do, you know? And so that's a person who we might do a 24-hour urine because we want to see how bad it is because that gives you an integrated measure. And we also measure an ACTH to see if it's high or if it's low. If it's low in the presence of high cortisol, then there's an adrenal tumor that doesn't need ACTH to make cortisol. It's autonomous. If the ACTH is high, then it's an ACTH-producing tumor, most commonly in the pituitary, but about 10%, 5% of the time, it's from a neuroendocrine tumor somewhere else in the chest or in the abdomen that is, for some reason, making ACTH when it's not supposed to, and it's driving the normal adrenals to make cortisol. Now, when it gets milder, it gets a lot harder. And the literature on this largely comes from patients who have incidentally discovered adrenal tumors. So now that everybody that comes to the emergency room gets a whole body CT scan, you know, because they say, I don't know what's going on. Let's put them in the CT scanner or figure it out. So it turns out that about 5 to 10% of us have one or more adrenal tumors, and we don't know about it. Now, that may sound crazy, but if you think about thyroid nodules, well, you know, 50% of us have thyroid nodules by the time we get to be 60. So if we go willy-nilly doing ultrasounds on everybody, which we shouldn't do, we're going to find all these thyroid tumors that aren't going to cause any problem and aren't going to, you know, require any, but we just created anxiety and extra work and cost because we did an inappropriate imaging test. So in this CT scan that the patient's getting in the ER for abdominal pain, they're looking for, I don't know, they're looking for a colon cancer or from, you know, an infarcted spleen or whatever, but they actually image the adrenals and they find an adrenal tumor. So the Italians, starting in the late 1970s, early 1980s, started saying, what's going on with these people? You know, with a thyroid tumor, I just measure a TSH and I can tell if it's overactive, TSH is low. And that's because the thyroid axis is a very dampened axis. It has some pulsatility, but thyroid hormone has a half-life of a week. And so the TSH and the thyroid hormone levels are the same in the morning, in the afternoon. There is a slight variation, but pretty much if it's normal, it's going to be normal in the morning, in the middle of the day, and at night. And the levels aren't going to change very much over time. But the adrenal's not like that. The adrenal is supposed to have these profound variations. If you think about it, if you go from 20 to 0.2, you know, that's a 100-fold variation every day that you're going through, all right? And that's normal. That's good physiology. It's like heart rate variability. The heart rate is not supposed to be constant. It's like you're almost dead. So adrenal is supposed to be, you know, high in the morning, low in the evening. So when they looked at these people, they did a bunch of testing. And what they teased out directly and indirectly that once the tumor gets to about 2.5 centimeters, you know, about an inch, then, you know, they all make a little bit of cortisol. All right. But is that little bit of cortisol buried in the noise and we'll never be able to detect it? Or is it sufficient, you know, significant? So and how do you tell? So actually, this is a situation where the dexamethasone suppression test is asking a very direct physiologic question. It's saying, I'm going to suppress the ACTH all the way, make sure there's none, and then I want to see how much cortisol you still make. All right. And so they did this in these people. And turns out, again, when the tumor gets about 2.5 centimeters, you start to pick up a little bit of cortisol above what we would consider a normal suppression, which I'm not going to give you an exact number, but really, if you do a lot of dexamethasone suppression tests, people suppress to less than 1 microgram per deciliter. But these people were like 1.8, 2, 2.5, 3, you know. Where when I was a fellow, we were taught that 5 was abnormal. That's for the people with severe disease. So these people sort of
the original guidelines, like before I went to fellowship, were from ACE, and it was like at 5. And then it was like as I was going through training, I was like literally seeing the publication saying, "Boy, you know, there's more mortality, more death and stuff in these people." And it, I think the Europeans brought it down to like 3, and then ultimately now to what you're saying. Essentially,
1.8 is 50 nanomoles per liter, so it's a nice round number in the European. But again, there's nothing magical about 1.8, it's like a continuous. And this is one of the tricky things. This is one of the tricky things is that I have sent people to surgery with a 3 centimeter adrenal tumor and a dex suppressed cortisol of 1.6 or 1.7, and they have adrenal insufficiency after the surgery. After we take out,
which means, and why is that significant for people listening?
So that means that that tumor was making enough cortisol to suppress the other adrenal. So that when we took out that tumor, they had a low cortisol, and it took some time, some number of months, for that other adrenal to get enough signal from the pituitary to grow back enough to make a normal amount of cortisol. So what we have very blunt instruments for assessing this condition. So if we as endocrinologists have a lot of gray zone, then how can some guy who's operating a lab in his garage, you know, and measuring these saliva tests give you definitive answers, you know, with, you know, some ridiculous set of tests that have never been validated? So I think that's what I want to emphasize to people. So again, when there's a smoking gun, when there's a reason to test, either because of history, physical, or known tumors that are of the size that are suspicious for disease, then I take the abnormal results with much more weight because they have a higher positive predictive value. And then I try to do one or two additional tests that look at some other aspect of the system. So let's take the patient with the adrenal tumor. I see a lot of these people in my clinic, you know, first I gauge, you know, on their size, you know, the size of the tumor, the larger it is, the more likely it's going to be making cortisol. That's just what happens. The second is I take a history and a physical. Amazing. I actually do that. Yes. So do they have any of those features? And a lot of times they don't have the overt features, but they have some more subtle features. So supraclavicular fat pads. Okay. If you look at people and they should, a fit person should have a little divot behind their clavicles that you can see. And if you have a skinny person who doesn't, who there's like a roll right over their clavicle that you can palpate a fatty lump there, that's not normal. Mm-hmm. And then people who are obese, they can be proportionately obese, where they have, you know, obesity everywhere. Their arms are thick. Their head and neck is proportionate to their abdomen. But other people are disproportionate. They have a lot of fat in their head and neck. Their arms are skinny. All right. And their belly is a little plump. That could be Cushing's. That could be glucocorticoid. And if you've seen any people who are chronically taking prednisone, that's kind of what they look like. You know, they don't often have the purple stretch marks or stuff. They also have the facial rounding and plethora. They have round red faces and they have redness up in their upper chest. And the muscle weakness that's caused by glucocorticoids is proximal myopathy. So I have them squat and come up without using their hands. I try to have them hold their arms out like this. I ask them if they have trouble changing a light bulb or getting in and out of a car, all right? And I ask them about recent changes. So one of the other tip-offs is, and weight gain is overdone. Like weight gain is not really the issue. If it's just weight gain, it's probably not Cushing's. I have people that come to me, I've gained 100 pounds in the last 5 years. I must have Cushing's. It's like, if you gain 100 pounds because of Cushing's in the last 5 years, you'd be dead. Okay. It just can't be, because those other things should accompany the weight gain. And if it's just weight gain, symmetrical, without myopathy, without skin thinning, it's not Cushing's. Okay. All right. Now, on the other hand, if they have hypertension, and they've been on one medicine for 15 years, and all of a sudden they're on three medicines and the blood pressure isn't controlled, then I'm concerned that something weird is going on. You know, I also screen them for primary aldosteronism, but that's a topic for another day. And then let's say they have mild diabetes, been managed with metformin for, again, 15 years. Now, there's a certain failure rate. Let's say they're not gaining weight, but let's say now they add, you know, a DPP-4 inhibitor. Now that's not working. Now they're on insulin. Now they're needing more insulin. You know, the blood sugar's not controlled. Something weird is going on there. Or let's say that they've been overweight for a while, but they have osteoporosis. Obese people don't get osteoporosis. So I think you have to think about, like, recent changes, things that don't make sense, things that don't fit. Things that you would see when you start somebody on prednisone. Mm-hmm. Then I would think about testing those people. And then the final thing that you have to realize also that we mentioned is that chronic illness of any sort is going to activate your stress response. And we call that, we used to call that pseudo-Cushing syndrome, but we now call it non-neoplastic hypercortisolism. So, you know, again, cortisol is supposed to be a stress response. And, you know, at the VA every week, I see men with battle trauma, right? That they watch their buddy get blown up in a foxhole and, you know, they come back stateside and they can't sleep at night. They have nightmares. They are hypervigilant and so on. And they're tired all the time. And if I do a dexamethasone suppression test on them, they may fail it, you know, because their axis is now overdriven with a maladaptive response. That's the way I look at this. So it's useful in the short term to have this high cortisol. But then if you have chronic stress, then the HPA axis forgets how to cycle. And then you get in this black hole that you can't get out of. And that is not only going to perpetuate the lack of circadian rhythm, but it's also going to worsen whatever disease got you there. So I think that's one of the tricky things about cortisol is that is the way that other chronic stress can lead to abnormal dynamics of the system and then perpetuate a bad situation.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, looking for things that don't make sense. I mean, that's you know, a pretty important point. In fact, one of the recent patients I had was. Yeah. Was kind of an amazing coincidental thing. It was one of my wife's friends was talking to her. My wife's a nurse. She doesn't do endocrine though, other than helping me with my new clinic and stuff. Right. And you know, and she had noticed some real subtle changes, maybe some facial rounding stuff. But then she started talking about suddenly needing blood pressure. And this girl has historically been pretty fit. And so she came and she finally said something to me. She's like, "Hey, so and so's." You know, I just had this, you know, she kind of looks this way. And by the way, she suddenly needs 3 blood pressure meds. And I was like, whoa, hold on, wait a second. The blood pressure thing, I feel like is a big deal in our world. And then I guess that then brings me to, you mentioned the diabetes. So, you know, Spencer and I do a lot of obesity medicine. We use a lot of GLP-1 receptor agonists. Right. These are to some degree game changing. I mean, the first one was out in 2005 when I was a med student, and they were essentially game changing then for type 2 diabetes. And so then that brings me to one of the recent studies that you were involved with. Mm-hmm. And you know, we talk about this mild autonomous cortisol secretion and these patients who have type 2 diabetes and they're not having blood glucose control like we would expect. When we treat people with diet, exercise, and the right medications like GLP-1 receptor agonists and some of these other medications that we have that are actually darn good that people don't realize, they shouldn't need insulin, in my opinion, unless something else is going on. And that leads us to the Catalyst trial. And maybe you can tell us a little bit of the background, how this happened. And then I have some skepticism that I want to talk about with it.
Sure. Yes. And, you know, and by no means is this a closed story. This mm-hmm. is just the first chapter of that story. But where this came about is that when the Italians were looking at these people with incidental adrenal nodules, they compared them to control populations, age-matched people that came in for their CT scan, but thank God they didn't have an adrenal tumor. And so they found out that these people had more hypertension, they had more diabetes, they had more osteoporosis, and so on. And then they kind of followed them longitudinally, and they were able to demonstrate increased mortality, increased cardiovascular events, and so on. So even this mild cortisol excess is not benign. You know, it's not going to kill you tomorrow like overt Cushing's might kill you in a few weeks. But you know, over 20 years is not a good thing to have. And it's just like being on prednisone for 20 years is not a good thing. So we already know that. And it makes sense. So then we ask the opposite question. Let's take these people who aren't responding to the usual diabetes medicines and see how many of those people might have an adrenal tumor. Okay. So we're going backwards now. In fact, that study was done a few times before Catalyst. So there was a great study that was done in France by Katargi and colleagues. It was in the early 2000s. They took 200 people with poorly controlled type 2 diabetes, A1C over 8%. They did an overnight dexamethasone suppression test on them all, and a quarter of them failed, right? A quarter of them failed, and then they went on to do more testing. And it turns out three of them had Cushing's disease, a pituitary tumor, making it, and nobody thought to test them for this. So they had bona fide Cushing syndrome, Cushing's disease, the real thing. And then another eight of them had abnormal testing of, actually 17 of them had additional abnormal testing besides the dexamethasone suppression tests of these other kind of tests of adrenal function. And eight of them wound up having adrenal tumors. All right. So it was about 4% of those people probably had mild autonomous cortisol secretion. So Catalyst tried to do this in a much larger study, took 1,000 patients who had poorly controlled type 2 diabetes. There were various criteria about how many drugs you had to be on, whether or not you had hypertension, whether or not you have poorly controlled hypertension, whether or not you had cardiovascular illness, which, of course, these are all chronic illnesses, right? So hold that thought. And we did a 1 milligram overnight dex suppression test on all of them. A quarter of them failed, just like the Katargi study. It actually wasn't surprising. It's actually kind of what I predicted based on what was done before. And again, Katargi was only one study of this. But, you know, only a few of those people in the Katargi study actually had a tumor that was causing their cortisol excess. Yeah. Now, then they measured ACTH and DHEA sulfate in all these people to look for people who might have Cushing's disease. And they were actually excluded from going on, all right, because they needed a full workup and shouldn't be in a trial. They got the standard of care. Unfortunately, it wasn't reported. There, you know, there's sort of rumors that there were a couple of these people, but we don't actually know the numbers for that. So then those people who didn't have a high ACTH, either normal or low ACTH, they all got a CT scan. And about 30% of those people had an adrenal abnormality. Ill-defined abnormalities. Some were actually tumors, some were just thickening and so on, but not 100%. So what can we say is the reason that they failed the dexamethasone suppression test? So some of them did have an adrenal tumor, and it's somewhere in that 30% of 25%. The others probably had this non-neoplastic hypercortisolism, all right? Be that as it may, what they then did is they offered those people who failed the dexamethasone suppression test to go into part two of the study, which was to randomize them to a glucocorticoid receptor antagonist, mifepristone, that we used to treat Cushing's, or placebo. And the hemoglobin A1C improvements were like 1.3% greater than placebo in the mifepristone group. So what do we know and what do we not know? Well, we know that a lot of these people fail a dex suppression test. The minority of them probably have MAX. The majority of them probably have non-neoplastic disease, but they all respond to mifepristone.
Yeah.
So is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing?
And this is the thing. This is what we're all confused about.
So what didn't we do? We didn't treat the people who didn't fail the dexamethasone suppression.
Right.
Right. So we don't know if they responded because they failed the dexamethasone suppression test or if everybody would have responded. Because remember, I told you before that one of the symptoms of adrenal insufficiency is hypoglycemia, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I was going to say it. Yeah. If we made everyone adrenally insufficient, because everyone shooters go
little adrenal insufficiency in these people.
Yeah.
And are you blocking that component that is maladaptive? Are you blocking that component that is required for survival, or a little bit of both? We don't know the answers to that. But I think, you know, again, what it told me, that the take-home message that I got from this is that this is a an approach that has not been studied that might be useful in clinical practice. It's not ready for prime time by any means, all right? But, you know, it validated the fact that we should be thinking about this and should be screening, because some of those people did have an adrenal tumor, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, but it's not 25%. It's probably closer to 5% or something like Katargi found, right? So, but even so, it's worth thinking about in this group of people, because what are you going to do? I mean, you're banging your head against the wall. Now, the other thing that wasn't done is that we didn't retest them after their glucose came down to normal. You know, we didn't repeat the dexamethasone suppression test once their A1C was down to goal. All right. So what we didn't determine is if the abnormal dex suppression test was reversible. Okay. Because currently, you don't have a sort of bariatric surgery or some, you know, inpatient, very low calorie diet. There's really nothing you can do for these people. You've already given them the kitchen sink. So I think this might be one approach, but I think what needs to be studied is how long do you need to treat? Does the abnormal cortisol dynamics return to normal in these people? You know, like, can you just give them a tune-up for a period of time? Yeah. Mm. And then send them on their merry way. But I don't, so I think it's, you know, what I always tell people is we did what we did and the data are the data. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Data are the data, you know, but what it means and the implementation, well, that's like, we're only in chapter one of 10 here.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. So, but again, I think it validates the fact that some of these people do have an adrenal tumor.
Yeah.
And you should think about that.
Yeah. So I think that's perfect. I mean, that's exactly why I wanted to talk to you about it, to get those insights. One of the other questions that comes up in our endocrine world, people ask, and some of this gets into, you know, it's hard to do trials, right? But because in clinical setting, according to guidelines that you've helped write, we would repeat the 1 milligram dex suppression, or maybe do it in a different way. I talked to Bill Young the other day, who, by the way, for everyone listening, he's another one of our, you know, sort of our adrenal superstars that we can talk to sometime. And he was, you know, talking about doing like a 4-day dex mm-hmm. suppression test or something that he would consider doing to try to tease out some of that stuff. What are your thoughts on that?
Well,
I know this gets complicated, but for
So I have seen people with small adrenal tumors in my clinic who fail a dex suppression test, but I'm pretty sure that it's non-neoplastic hypercortisolism. So what I do with those people, so if they have an adrenal tumor, I usually want two abnormal kinds of tests, but not the same test. So it turns out actually that the dex suppression test is fairly reproducible. So, you know, if somebody fails it one day, they're probably going to fail it the next day. But what they may, what may make a difference is if you use more dexamethasone. So with an adrenal tumor, it really doesn't matter how much you use, because again, you're suppressing the ACTH all the way and the amount of cortisol coming out should be the same, no matter what. If I give a milligram, if I get 5 milligrams, if I get 8 milligrams, if I do it one day, 2 days, 3 days, it should be zero. If it's non-neoplastic, it does matter how much I give, because the axis may be resistant to suppression with 1 milligram, but if I give 4 milligrams, it will probably suppress. And the other thing is that the reason it doesn't suppress with 1 milligram is because the ACTH doesn't suppress. So if I repeat the dex suppression test, I repeat it with a higher dose and I measure ACTH and cortisol. All right. And so that's one thing. And then the second thing is I also want to measure a baseline ACTH and DHEH sulfate in these patients. Now, ACTH is sort of like the TSH. And you might say, well, why don't you just do that to begin with? Well, it's a little tricky because ACTH is not as stable as TSH is. I have to measure it early in the morning when it's supposed to be high because I'm looking for it to be low. I'm looking for it to be low chronically. And then why do I measure DHEA sulfate? Because that is also an ACTH-dependent steroid. And if your ACTH and your pituitary axis is running in low gear for a long time, then eventually your ACTA, your DHEA sulfate starts to drop in parallel. And so if I see a low ACTH, a low DHEA sulfate, and the cortisol doesn't suppress with any amount of dex I give, that's what an adrenal tumor does. Mm-hmm. If it's non-neoplastic, often the DHEAS is high, not low. Okay. The ACTH actually tends to be low itself because of that flattened circadian rhythm. All right. It's not zero, but it doesn't rise normally in the morning, but it doesn't suppress with dexamethasone. So that's sort of the ways that I tease out neoplastic versus non-neoplastic in these people.
Now, in the Catalyst trial, I think endocrinologists, we've been trained, at least since I was in training, to start using the DHEA sulfate because of how statistically very good it is at doing exactly what you just said. Yeah. It was used in the Catalyst trial to help not confirm, but sort of at least support the issue, right?
Right. They reported a little bit of that data, and it was lower in the people that failed the dex suppression test than the people who didn't fail, but it wasn't hugely, there's quite a bit of variation, and it does go down after about age 65 or 70. It starts to decline in normal individuals. The ACTH and DHEAS were mainly done to try to find people with high values that were suggestive of ACTH-dependent Cushing's to remove them from the study. So they had to be either normal or low, but that hasn't been analyzed very well yet. So again, it was more to remove people rather than to confirm people. Now, if we're looking to do surgery for an adrenal tumor, we definitely measure those things.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing, because it was medical therapy rather than surgical therapy, there wasn't a great attempt to subclassify people. So it was sort of, it was designed to ask the question, how many people fail a dex suppression test? And then of those people, do they respond to mifepristone with improved glycemia? We don't make any claims that these people had, surgically remediable disease. We don't make any claims that this is an irreversible process, or at least I don't. But I think it's just a first chapter in this story of looking at a potential other strategy for people who are failing all conventional therapies.
Are they going to do cardiovascular outcome trial stuff and all sorts of extra?
Not with mifepristone. This company, and I am a consultant for Corcept Therapeutics, I'll make full disclosure on that. They have a second drug. The problem with mifepristone is it's RU486. It's the abortion drug. So it also has anti-progestin activities and, it causes endometrial hypertrophy and so on. They have very selective drugs now. And relacorilant is one of these that has been through clinical trials, actually has a PDUFA date in a week or two with the FDA to know if it's going to be approved. Any longer term studies will be with one of these drugs that isn't carrying all that baggage. They have other versions that are being trialed in fatty liver, for example, right now. So, and I think we should think about these as selective glucocorticoid receptor modulators, just like we think of selective estrogen receptor modulators, that drugs might have the potential to antagonize the effects of glucocorticoids more in some tissues than others. You want something that works really well in the liver, right? You want to lower glucose, you want to lower liver fat and things like that, but you don't want to be an antagonist in the vasculature or, places like that. So I think there is the potential now to think about doing this in a selective way, at least for a limited period of time, to reset the system. And, I think this whole concept of re-entraining the circadian rhythm needs to be studied further because, for every one patient we see with MAX, there's 10 or 100 who have non-neoplastic hypercortisolism that are suffering from this abnormal circadian rhythm. And we just say, well, we just need to fix the underlying problem. But that often is not all that easy. You know, if you don't sleep well and you don't have sleep apnea and you don't respond to melatonin, there's not a lot we can do for you right now. Cortisol antagonism can be used for that.
Interesting.
I mean, I do think about this commonly. It's not hard. It's not, you know, intrinsic endocrinology, but it's just dealing with the maladaptive response that the endocrine system puts on top of whatever disease you have.
Yeah. Yeah. And just for people out there, I think, I can't remember who said it that stuck in my mind. Some of these medications we use though, in this case, they say, you know, these aren't for the faint of heart. You don't just willy nilly take these medications because you think your cortisol is high. I mean, these are pretty big deal medications that we have to monitor really closely under our supervision, right?
Right. There was because mifepristone actually makes your cortisol go up, you know, because it blocks the negative feedback. And so, you make so much cortisol that it activates the mineralocorticoid receptor. So hypokalemia was quite common. In this group. They also
get potassium.
Low potassium and withdrawal symptoms. If you ever stop prednisone abruptly on somebody, they get muscle aches and weakness. When you cure somebody with Cushing's, they get this.
Yeah.
So they're very expensive. They have a narrow therapeutic index and they have some significant adverse events. You know, it's not like aldosterone. With aldosterone, you know, whether it's high or not high, I can just send you to the corner drugstore to take 12.5 milligrams of spironolactone. It's been around for 60 years. It's $4 a month. You know, at 12.5 milligrams a day is almost no side effects, and it's really effective. I don't have that with cortisol, right? And I'm also, like, if I overblock aldosterone a little bit, it's probably not going to cause, unless you have bad kidney functions, it's not going to cause any problem. Overblock cortisol a little too much, that could be... very morbid for you.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, this is not your kids don't try this at home.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is actually not something to play, but it does need to be studied. So I would say firmly that this is still a research question. I'm not ready for clinical practice, but you know, I think the recognition, what we've been doing all along, you know, the heightened awareness, the appropriate testing, that's all we should be doing that. This broader use of glucocorticoid antagonists, so on, we don't have the full story yet.
Yeah, that's awesome. So that was all really, really, really good stuff. Hopefully everyone appreciates it. There's one last thing that I definitely want to follow up with you on.
All right.
I think it's probably been about a year and a half. As I recall, we were both speaking at the National ACE meeting and somehow we got off topic and you started telling me and somebody else about how you were asked to get involved in a woolly mammoth testosterone research study. I just want to hear how that all turned out.
Well, because my lab does steroid mass spectrometry, comprehensive profiling of steroids in serum or in research samples, somebody was trying to look at what happened to the woolly mammoth as they went into extinction. So they had tusks from the mammoth, and you know, tusks are a tooth, and they grow continuously throughout life. And various things from the circulation get trapped in the dentin as the tooth is growing. And so you have basically a history of the entire animal's life in the tusk. And so you can measure, for example, carbonate isotopes and tell when it was in a rainy season and when it was in a dry season. And so you see these seasonal fluctuations that correspond to the lifetime of the animal. And so we were looking at cortisol. And it turns out cortisol doesn't get preserved well, but what does get preserved well is testosterone. And it happened to be a male mammoth. Elephants, which are the closest living relative to the mammoth, the males have a what's called a must season, which is during the mating season. Must is when the elephants make 10 times, 20 times more testosterone than normal, and they get very aggressive. You know, sort of like they're doping, right? And they're, you know, and they dribble urine and they kill each other and they try to mate. It's driven by the must gland in the forebrain that disinhibits the negative feedback. So they just constantly make testosterone. So we actually found these cycles of testosterone that corresponded to the must episode in this mammoth that lived 10,000 years ago. And they were preserved through the history in the tusk. And so we published that in Nature about a year and a half ago. Well, we are still working on that, actually. We're looking at Asian elephants, and we're trying to see if we can, you know, reproduce that. And then we want to look at mastodons, but which are a little bit older. So, we, you know, these are not, these are precious commodities. So we have to make sure our extraction methods are good and everything before we go and use the precious samples. But yeah, so if what I told my kids is that if in the next Ice Age episode, Manny has a must episode, you know that it was based on science and we did it here at Michigan.
That's amazing. All right. Well, I don't normally, I would never say go blue, but I'll say go blue for you. That's pretty cool.
Well, I root for Michigan State, except when they're playing two teams. Okay. And I think Iowa and Michigan. Okay. Otherwise, I'm rooting for them.
So, hey, when you were at Iowa, did you ever catch any of the wrestling there, by the way?
I did. I had season tickets. And I remember Arizona. That was when Dan Gable was coach.
Yeah, yeah.
And I and Tommy Brands was wrestling. Not, you know, he's a coach now, right? So, so I remember Arizona came in rated number one. All right, and it was like early in the season. We beat them 52-2.
Wow.
And then we were number one for the rest of the year.
Wow,
so
that's
yeah,
amazing.
It was great. Iowa wrestling is fantastic. Yeah.
I'll give you my one humble brag. One of my best matches ever was at Iowa, Carver Hawkeye Arena. Place was packed. What? And actually had to I just had a bad weekend of cutting weight, but I had to barely make weight. And I pulled off an upset against a guy named Mike Zadek. Hopefully he's not listening to this, but he's a great guy.
He was
a star dude. And anyways, it was fun to kind of shut down the crowd at Carver Hawkeye, where it's just insane there.
It was insane.
Yeah. Bang. Unfortunately, he placed higher in Nationals than I did.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, you know, I can't claim to have done anything like that.
Well, that's just for everyone out there. You are, you know, I've seen you run. You are an elite runner, and you're a doc who lifts, and, you know, really, really appreciate your expertise and the way you are able to articulate things. And I can tell you all the endocrinologists around the world also appreciate that. We do.
Well, thanks. And of course, Bill Young was I used to read his papers. You know, people ask me, how did you get to be good at this? I said, I read Bill Young's paper and he did exactly what he did.
Yeah.
And, you know, Carl, this is a great service, and Spencer, that you're doing for the community to try to, you know, get through all the noise and the confusion and try to drill down to, you know, what the data actually show and how we should proceed and how we should help ourselves and help our patients.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on. You're a wealth of knowledge.
Pleasure.
Yeah. And I'll be sure to hopefully stay away from those elephants during their high distance.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, no, that's bad news. Okay. And listen, happy holidays, everybody.
Yeah, you too. Here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll